Hello there. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. It's Andrew West here on RN and podcast, inside the School of Jihad, where the Taliban learned its harsh brand of religion.
They have learned how to engage in spin doctoring, how to manage their PR campaigns really efficiently. They have the same ideologies, the same primitive beliefs.
That's ahead on the show. And what happens when you give free rein to police during a pandemic? A group of Christian leaders wants the Prime Minister to increase Australia's intake of refugees from Afghanistan, and they've invoked the founder of Australian liberalism to support their case. Their spokesman is Baptist Minister and former World Vision Chief Tim Costello.
We believe the intake should be 20,000, what Britain and Canada are doing, and have never seen such a groundswell of support and right across the Christian church for this. I've just come off a Zoom meeting with Catholics and Pentecostals and Australian Christian lobby. Right across the very often disunited church, there is a groundswell for us taking 20,000 because people have been so touched and distressed by what they're seeing.
Yes, I see it's not only you, but the Catholic Archbishop of Brisbane, Mark Coleridge, the Anglican Archbishop of Sydney, Kanishka Raphael, have also spoken out about the need for a much higher refugee intake. Why are Christian leaders so concerned about the refugees from an Islamic country?
Well, I think there's two things going on. First is a very strong sense of moral foundations around being loyal to those who were loyal to us. And that's getting people out, obviously. And then the Christian sense that God's heart is particularly for the stranger, as it's called in the Hebrew scriptures, the refugee. God's heart is particularly for their plight. And this, in some ways, has reignited a very strong Christian tradition of hospitality that rises above religion and nationalism. Christian faith, you know, is profoundly internationalist. And I know in Mitchell, Immigration Minister Alex Hawke's electorate, we had a Zoom meeting with the churches on Friday night. Within 24 hours, there were 30 on that Zoom call. 50 signed a letter. 40 churches in the Immigration Minister's electorate, Pentecostal, Catholic, Uniting, Anglican, two bishops, Bishop Vincent Long of Parramatta for the Catholic Church and Chris Edwards for the Anglicans. This has touched a nerve that is running very, very deep.
Well, we know the Prime Minister is a committed Pentecostal Christian. I mean, what do you hope to awaken in his consciousness here?
I've written that there are two sources to guide him. One is the Bob Menzies tradition. In an article I quoted in 1959, International Refugee Day, Bob Menzies saying, Australia per head has taken the most refugees of any, over 200,000. This is since the war. We will be known as a warm-hearted, generous people. Now, that Menzian tradition was particularly seen with Malcolm Fraser and 50,000 Vietnamese who were fleeing Vietnam, even with John Howard and 4,000 airlifted Kosovars in 1999, Tony Abbott, dragged kicking and screaming, maybe, but he got there to 12,000 Syrians and an additional intake. So really, we are saying there's a Menzian tradition here, Prime Minister, and look to your faith. Jesus, the one who fled with his parents to Egypt because of the massacre of innocent boys under two at his birth. So those are the two grounds of appeal.
Now, we're not talking here, Tim, just about Afghans who worked with Australian coalition forces during that 20-year period. I think you want a much more broader refugee resettlement, even from those who had no connection to Australia in Afghanistan, people that you've identified or communities that you've identified as being especially at risk. Am I right?
Yeah, we all know that it's women and children, especially at risk, that people who are fleeing, and it'll be the neighbouring countries that have to pick up the burden, that on any burden-sharing quota, our estimate would be Australia's share would be actually up around 40,000. Now, with pipeline capacities and the numbers who have to be quarantined, with no embassy in Kabul, so we're having to do assessments now from Ireland of people who are refugees. I understand even in Dubai, we aren't able to process them. There are real capacity pipeline issues. But we have seen before that Australia has the capacity to do this, that we should be stepping up to do this. So this isn't just the evacuees who worked with us, whose lives are immediately at risk. This is those who are desperately becoming refugees because of this seizing of power.
We may be talking in years to come about a couple of million refugees coming out of Afghanistan. Tim, you have been in your service as the head of World Vision in a lot of refugee camps around the world. I never want to suggest that the refugee camps are a suitable permanent solution, but is there a possible medium-term solution in the sense that some refugee camps, were they to be established particularly in on Afghan borders, can be improved to the point of having proper housing, power, electricity, businesses?
Yeah, there are some refugee camps that are much better than others. There are some that can't be improved because of the location. I've been in Cox's Bazaar with the Rohingya, and I described it like entering the gates of hell, the humidity, the proximity of so many people crammed together, and there had to be another solution for them. Dadaab and remote Kenya, where there's been refugees for over 25 years, and really, you know, a city of half a million of them is very hard to turn into something permanent. But in terms of Afghanis, if Pakistan was prepared to set up what will be refugee camps for them in a permanent way and incorporate them, Turkey will obviously get a lot of these refugees if they were prepared to do the same. There may be some hope there, absolutely.
If this turns as disastrous as it potentially could, and the West may have to do what it did in Iraq during the 1990s and have some protected no-fly zones as it did for the Kurds, that worked out okay for the Kurds. Could that be a possible semi-partial solution in Afghanistan?
Yeah, it did work well for the Kurds, and aren't we grateful it was the Kurds who did all the heavy fighting to defeat ISIS? They were the ones we ultimately relied on. So there are models of allowing people dignity with sufficient protection to actually get on with their lives and see a future. Most who are refugees know they can't go back because of political or religious persecution. Hazaras, for example, who are Shia, and the Taliban and Pashtuns in Afghanistan can't stand. If they're sufficiently protected, if they can see a future, if they can start to build houses and plant gardens and have education for their kids, that is possible, but it requires on sufficient protection.
Just finally, Tim, on another matter, Australia is rapidly accelerating its vaccination program against COVID-19. What is our moral obligation, though, to the developing world, where in parts of the developing world, we're seeing vaccination rates of 1 and 2%?
Yeah, this is a moral and an existential issue. Morally, it is totally wrong for anyone of Christian faith who believes that when you approach a human, you're approaching something of God. To say they have the image of God says they already have something from God, and their dignity must be equal to every other person. So that's the moral argument. The existential argument is that we know the variants and the mutating of the variants happen where people aren't vaccinated, and they come to our shores, as we've seen with Delta. So we aren't safe until everyone is safe. That's why MICA Australia, that I lead, is running a campaign, End COVID for All. And I was nearly weeping seeing talk of us having to destroy potentially AZ here, AZ that somehow got turned into Hemlock in the public mind here in Australia, when that could be saving lives of Indonesians and people in India, through Myanmar, where there's a terrible outbreak
Tim Costello, who's also the head of the group Micah Australia. And this is the Religion and Ethics Report. So where did the Taliban leaders and fighters learn their harsh brand of Islam? For almost 40 years, madrasas or religious schools have operated in Pakistan's tribal areas. But since 2001, a new generation of Taliban have also been nurtured by technology and the simple desire for money. Dr. Farooq Yusuf grew up in the heart of the Pakistan tribal area. He knows the culture intimately. His new book is called Pakistan, Regional Security and Conflict Resolution, and he joined me earlier.
This new breed, quote-unquote, of the Taliban militant is someone who can speak multiple languages, who knows how to use social media, who knows how to speak English fluently. So this new breed of Taliban comes from most sections of societies, be it universities, be it high schools, be it madrasas, be it family networks. But in terms of the Pakistani Taliban, they are mostly comprised of Pashtuns and Punjabis. However, they are in a very small number. A majority of the Afghans is either indigenous or those Afghans who had spent a significant amount of time in Pakistan.
Are the madrasas in the Pashtun tribal areas of Pakistan still an important part of the militant movement?
Yes and no. Yes, because they still provide literature for radicalization. But no, because that same literature is being taught in public schools in Pakistan. So we see this new trend where even in Australia, the recent suspects who had connections with the Islamic State were actually educated and university students. So madrasas do play a part, but not as much as other elements such as social networks, propaganda, social media, family networks, and universities, and socioeconomic factors as well.
What would this current generation of Taliban leaders, and perhaps more importantly, Taliban fighters on the ground, what would they have been indoctrinated with, or what would they have learned?
They have learned how to engage in spin doctoring, how to manage their PR campaigns really efficiently, because in my observation, it's an old wine in a new bottle. They have the same ideologies, the same primitive beliefs. In the long run, they would obviously launch actions and operations against human rights activists, women, people who had worked with Western agencies. But in the short run, they are smartly using the new media and the new technology to say the right things at the right time.
Didn't Imran Khan's government in Pakistan actually give a large amount of money to a university that's nicknamed the University of Jihad? I think one of its alumni is the former Taliban chief Mullah Omar.
Yeah, exactly. It's actually a Madrasa Haqqaniya, which is one of the largest madrasas in South Asia. And its founder, Sami ul Haq, was actually known as the father of the Taliban. However, the argument that Imran Khan and his government actually gave was that the only reason they wanted to fund these madrasas was to bring them in the national fold. I have not seen any progress as of yet, but the current state and the military and the political leadership is of the opinion that they cannot bring madrasas in the national fold unless they spend money on them and unless they improve the socioeconomic condition of the students and the teachers who are actually based in the madrasas. That's why a government also recently introduced a scheme where the teachers who actually are teaching these madrasas will be paid monthly salaries from the state. However, it's still yet to be seen how effective it is.
From what I can gather, are you saying that the education in the madrasas and the education in the Pakistan public school system has gotten much more similar over the last 10 or 20 years?
It was always similar. Even in my school and my high school, we've always had mandatory Islamic and Pakistan studies. And in those subjects, we often had themes where wars were glorified. So the only differences between a madrasa and a public schools is that in our school, we had an option to study science, biology, chemistry, physics, English, literature. Whereas in madrasas, they initially focus on Islamic law, Islamic history, Islamic scriptures, translations, and then in their later stages, they're also asked to study science and mathematics. The issue and the problem basically arises with these Salafi and Deobandi madrasas, which actively promote and encourage jihad against the West. The foundations of radicalization in a society like Pakistan are actually laid not only in madrasas or the schools, but in the streets and the mosques, in your social circles, in your families. So it's a multifaceted phenomena.
What sort of young people, young men in particular, might have been drawn in, though, to the Taliban, especially in those tribal areas?
From my experience and research, during the first wave, it was soon after the US invasion of Afghanistan, the first wave of militancy until 2010, most of the young people who joined the Pakistani and the Afghan Taliban and tribal areas were mostly encouraged by financial means, because the Taliban were engaged in smuggling, narcotics, kidnapping for ransom. So becoming a member of the Taliban was actually paying more than a normal, ordinary job in a tribal area. However, since they were able to join those organizations, they were also indoctrinated. And then a financial means and a financial objective became ideological objectives. Later on, youth who were either in the lower socioeconomic strata of the society joined the Taliban, or those who felt strongly ideologically about the West and a Western invasion in Afghanistan. And that's why you see a lot of university students who also joined these militant organizations more recently.
Dr. Farouk Yusuf, his book is Pakistan, Regional Security and Conflict Resolution. And you're with Andrew West. This week, we were very sad to hear of the death of a frequent contributor to this program, the Professor of Religion and Society at Monash University, Gary Bouma. Gary was a brilliant scholar and a champion of religious pluralism and multiculturalism. His intellect and eloquence will be greatly missed. Now, rubber bullets on the streets of Melbourne, jail sentences for lockdown protesters in Sydney. And what about the New South Wales Police Commissioner telling officers they're no longer accountable if they wrongly issue citizens with a fine? What's happened to basic human freedoms during the pandemic? Professor Justine Nolan is a renowned human rights lawyer and director of the Human Rights Institute at the University of New South Wales. Justine, welcome.
Thanks, Andrew.
When I see rubber bullets used on protesters or people being fined because a police officer doesn't consider walking your dog to be a sufficiently vigorous form of exercise that allows you to remove your mask. Do I have to be a kind of right-wing libertarian to be worried about this?
No, in fact, you'd probably think that you are not living in Australia or the Australia as we would tend to have idealised about how we live. You know, what we've seen in the last 18 months is more and more restrictions and often hastily devised restrictions placed on the community and placed on individuals to deal with, you know, a global emergency, a global public health emergency. And there are many restrictions which may be legitimate and sort of proportionate and necessary, but there are also many concerns I have in the way that our governments and our policing have responded to this emergency.
Well, it seems one of the major concerns must be the authority or the discretion given to an individual police officer when you've got the police commissioner basically saying, go for it, issue as many fines as you need to or you want to. That seems, you know, very alarming.
What we're seeing is really, I think, in that instance where there was a clear signal from the police leadership that there was no accountability in relation to fines giving. And, you know, it was a real direction to basically police our way out of this pandemic. And I think it was a direct right turn from the community policing approach that we've had for so long. But that sort of instruction is really a failure of leadership to tell officers in advance that if they get something wrong, there'll be no consequences. That is not the way that we built policing and the ideal around community policing in Australia. And it's enforcement at all costs. And it's really, you know, showing that we've got one trick, which is to police our way out of the pandemic.
I notice, and we're certainly not alone, Freedom House says 158 out of 192 countries have curbed some form of human rights during this pandemic. Have we been conditioned to it now?
I mean, it is astonishing if you think about the restrictions that have been placed on us in the last 18 months. When you're thinking about dealing with an emergency like this, there are many restrictions which are going to be reasonable. But what you have to ask each time is, are the restrictions that are being imposed necessary? Are they being done in a manner that's reasonable? And are they proportionate to the threat? And I guess one of the dangers that we have is that we may simply be setting a mode for how we continue. There might be a danger that some of these emergency provisions may just continue. And so I'm not saying that all of these laws, you know, are disproportionate. Many of the laws that we've seen have been necessary. It has been important to restrict people's movements, to cut down on the spread of the infection. But we have to look at the process for the way that we've devised the laws, the transparency around it, and that there is some sort of sunset clause involved, that we get to a point where we say, okay, that's enough, that these laws and the breadth of powers which we're seeing, not only with the police, but the Federal Health Minister as well, are confined to a very particular emergency and that there's an end to them.
Are lockdowns, when they are open-ended, lockdowns when there is no specific end date, a breach of human rights?
So I guess human rights is all about this balancing act. And, you know, we sort of come back to this question of reasonableness, which is a really murky concept in some ways. I mean, we tease it out looking at particular circumstances. But basically, again, what you're asking is it reasonable that the government impose this restriction? And are they doing it when they're imposing restrictions on our rights? Are they doing it in the least restrictive way possible? And so one argument about open-ended lockdowns is that that's not the case. What you're looking for is some signal that the mechanism they're using is proportionate, an indeterminate lockdown that might impose things like curfews and serious restrictions of movement are not proportionate to the threat. But so much, again, depends on the context with it.
What are the long-term implications, Justine, of some of the surveillance measures that we've introduced? I certainly understand the need, for example, QR codes. They absolutely help the contact tracers. There's a very strong public health justification. But do you worry that governments might find reasons to extend things like QR codes when you check into shops or restaurants? Suddenly these things are justified as long-term measures, so we know where the population is?
Most definitely. And I think, you know, there are places around the world, countries around the world, where you have seen that happen, that it has become the norm. in places like China, if you look at the detailed surveillance that was available before the pandemic to track people's movements. And there is a danger that people just become complacent and accept this. And I think, you know, we're living in an age where there are so many incursions on privacy, and a generation that's being brought up where they expect their information to be able to be accessed by private companies. And they may have less concerns than people would have had 20 years ago. But there's also this sort of notion that information gathered is used for a limited purpose. And how are you going to enforce that? And how are you going to police that? We'll probably see it again if home quarantine takes off in Australia, that it will be accompanied by some form of electronic monitoring. And so the question will be, how is that information safeguarded? You know, when is it destroyed? Who has access to it? We really have to think about how we build in protections for the information that we're giving away.
How much damage, Justine, have closed borders, stranding Australian citizens overseas, done to the value of Australian citizenship?
I think it's done enormous damage to the citizenship, the concept of citizenship within Australia. I mean, and if you think about, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic has really highlighted the ways in which citizenship laws in Australia are based on restriction, that way back to 1901 when we were restricting people who came in, many years later around the White Australia policy as well, we're now taking a different form of restriction, and the government has long trumped, you know, we decide who comes into this country, and now that applies to citizens as well as non-citizens. And so I think that the tool that the government has predominantly relied on is border closures, and to our detriment, we were complacent and didn't rely on other mechanisms as well, like vaccines. And so now that is the primary way that they have been looking to maintain our safety during this pandemic. But it's enormous damage. And we have tens of thousands of Australians who have a right to return to this country who have been unable to for the last 18 months.
Does it violate any principle of international human rights law? I think I can only count Cuba and North Korea that at the moment the other countries that are restricting the rights of their citizens to leave. I don't even think China restricts the rights of its citizens to leave. Well, Australia's in some questionable company by the sounds of it.
Yeah, probably not the greatest partners when we're considering human rights. You know, like I said, this right can be restricted in exceptional and limited circumstances, and that could include a pandemic. But there's a framework that international law builds around those restrictions. And I said it's got to be, you know, sort of the least intrusive measure to sort of achieve the objective, which here is public safety. And you've got to look at this question around legitimacy, necessity, and proportionality. And I would argue that in this case, there are other ways that the government needs to investigate to supplement public safety in the face of emergency, that it shouldn't just be relying on border closures to do that.
Speaking of passports, what do you make of the proposals for vaccine passports?
So this is something I think that will be with us for some time. And this is the idea that a vaccine passport may give you access, because of your vaccination status, to certain rights or freedoms that other people will not have because they're not complying with that. So it acts in many ways as an incentive in order to get vaccinated. And again, you know, much of this depends on the context, and so much also depends on access to a vaccine. It may be completely legitimate to require vaccination in certain workplaces like aged care or childcare, healthcare, or as New South Wales done is also in quarantine and airport workers in construction. But you've got to predicate any requirement for vaccination on access to vaccination. You've got to ensure that everybody has the ability to access that vaccine and then can make that decision to basically curtail that right or their freedoms if they choose not to get vaccinated. So it is a legitimate mechanism of dealing with the pandemic, but you have to have it coupled with access and equity in order to have that discussion.
Just finally, Justine, on another subject, this program has long had an interest in the issue of modern slavery. We've covered it extensively. You're also very active on this issue. The Senate has passed a bill to ban the importation of goods made with slave labour. What's the next step?
So the next step for this bill is for it to go to the House of Representatives. Interestingly, in the Senate, it passed in the Senate without the support of the government. So it will face a hard road to get support in the House of Representatives without the support of the government. So this basically is a complement to what Australia already has in place with its Modern Slavery Act, which requires companies to report on the risks in their operations and supply chains, which is basically requiring them to be more transparent. But it doesn't actually couple it with sort of action. And what this forced labour bill that has just passed the Senate is trying to do is basically saying, we will not allow goods into this country which have been made with forced labour or slavery. And this is something that the US has used for a long time in their Tariff Act. And it's an effective way of getting companies to look far more deeply into their supply chain and would complement and work very well with our modern slavery act. So it's hard to understand a rational reason of why the government would not support this and why we would want to include and encourage companies to bring goods into this country made by slaves. So I think it's a piece of legislation that the government should support and others. And, you know, it would be helpful to stand with the current Modern Slavery Act to give it more force in this country to take a real stand against goods coming in that are made with forced labour.
Professor Justine Nolan, she's the director of the Australian Human Rights Institute at the University of New South Wales. Justine's an internationally recognised expert on human rights law and human trafficking. Thanks for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thanks so much, Andrew. My pleasure.
And that is the program for this week. You can follow us at the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to Hong Jiang, Jennifer Parsonage and Hamish Camilleri. I'm Andrew West. The Religion and Ethics Report is back next week.